Oh, there's one.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God, oh my God.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Did you really think this out?
Hi.
I mean, there's no rhyme or reason.
It's just, I don't know.
Okay, you with me? Welcome to Essential Salt for Maine Public Radio. I'm Jess Miller. One thing that's always been true about being a Mainer is appreciating the power of a good story. As we all know, a good story isn't necessarily one that's easy to listen to. It can be something hard to report or difficult to tell in a way that does everybody justice. This story we're about to hear is one of those stories. It's profound and funny and true, and it tunes directly into what matters most to the people telling it. It's one of my favorite Salt pieces of all time, and while it was recorded a while ago in 2013, its message about the importance of local news and the everyday courage of the people who bring it to you will never, ever get old. This is the story, Parts of Speech, from Emily Kwong.
It was the 17th of June, 2005, when 56-year-old Doug Harlow stepped up to the microphone.
You know, this really sucks, not having a voice. But it's a message to everybody who can hear this voice now. Don't smoke.
Earlier that year, doctors had found cancer on Doug's vocal cords. In order to stay alive, he would have to lose his voice. So while a friend monitored the recording, Doug said some things to his family that he'd never be able to say again.
I love you, Mary Lou. Love you. Love you guys. Love you, Johnny. Love you, Georgia. Love you, Mary Lou. I love you, Mary Lou. Here, Sadie. Come on, Sadie.
It's been 8 years. There's a new dog.
Ugly. Can you sit? Good boy. Would you like to be in a radio documentary?
And the throat cancer is gone.
A simple yes or no will do.
Doug came home from the hospital without vocal cords. That's because surgeons had removed his entire larynx, which is the organ of sound production. They cut a small hole at the base of his throat to allow him to breathe. And to speak, doctors handed him something called an electrolarynx. It was black, palm-sized, and battery-powered.
I remember it being like a four in a bandage. Something that was a machine that I was supposed to be able to talk with, through. I didn't give myself any choice. You're gonna learn how to use it, and then you're gonna go back to work. And that was it.
Doug is 5'11", with brown eyes. His gaze is direct. The number 13 is tattooed on his left hand, which he applied himself with pencil lead and cigarette ash. This is the hand he speaks with.
There's another couple buttons for pitch, up and down, so I could speak in a lower voice. I speak in a higher voice. It's not easy to use. It's exhausting.
Doug wears his electrolarynx around his neck on a black cord. He'll hold it flush against his throat, and with the push of a button, the voice box vibrates. Kind of like his vocal cords used to.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines.
It's not an unpleasant sound, but you'd never mistake it for a human voice. One of the first times Doug was out in public, he went to a Mr. Paperback bookstore. He approached a female clerk whose back was turned and...
I approached her, saying, can you help me? She turned around, screamed, and ran into a back room, slammed the door shut. I said, great, I've got a lifetime of this shit.
Doug rebounded quickly. He returned to work at the Morning Sentinel 5 weeks after his surgery. His colleagues wondered if he'd keep reporting or take a silent post behind the copy desk. When Doug made interview calls, sources hung up on him. They accused him of making a prank phone call. Colin Hickey sat directly across from him.
And this would just drive Doug crazy. Because, you know, he couldn't do his job. He couldn't get the information. And there were points where he'd ask me, can you make the call? Hey, my colleague has a mechanical voice. You've been hanging up on him. So when he calls next, just hold on and you'll get used to it.
Doug kept calling. And eventually, he stopped asking Colin for help.
Eventually, and I don't know if it was weeks, I don't know if it was months, but eventually, this artificial voice started to sound like Doug again.
I finally learned how to use this thing and how to, throw in an inflection.
These days, Doug is one of the paper's busiest reporters. He interviews cops and criminals and listens to the police scanner for activity. When he calls for information, the detectives understand his questions.
Sheriff's Department, Dispatch Marlow.
Good afternoon, Doug Arlo calling. Hey.
How's you anywhere?
What, you recognize my voice?
Yes, sir. So, what do you need today? We haven't had anything much going on.
Yeah, well, that's my question.
I already anticipated it.
Well, I...
Good day.
All right, well, that's good news. Thank you.
Doug is navigating life just fine with a voice box. He can say anything he wants to, but that doesn't mean he's always heard. It's changed the way he relates to people. Even his wife of 27 years, Mary Lou.
I'm still talking the way that I always spoke when he had a voice, too. So it is something that I have to try to keep in mind, even like during an argument, giving him the opportunity to argue back, because I can get louder than what he can. So that kind of stuff is real. It is what it is. Not that I ever intend to do it, but I do it.
What do you do when you're not being heard?
I shut up, and that's not like me. You know, I used to be outspoken a lot more than I am now because I cannot be heard, and if I can be heard, then I'm not gonna say it. It's frustrating at times. It makes me angry at times still.
Parties or loud restaurants can get discouraging. There's a lot Doug wants to say, but he ultimately depends on technology to say it.
It's the only thing I have, it's the only way that I can speak. And that's kind of weird if you slow down for a minute and think about that. You know, when the power goes out finally and fully, when the mountain meets the sea at Armageddon, I'm not gonna have batteries. And then I will be silent.
But Doug is far from silent. He's still heard because he's still here.
I knew I would survive. Because the last thing I want to do is die. My kids wouldn't have had a father. My wife wouldn't have had a husband. So I chose life. And this is what it sounds like.
For Salt Radio, I'm Emily Kwong.
Okay. Baby on the mic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What do you think, Russ?
You are listening to the sounds of Doug's grandson. His name is Russell Doug Philbrick. And he came by the studio with his mom, Georgia, to meet Emily, who joined us on Zoom. When's the last time you saw each other?
Probably 12 years
been,
ago.
Yeah, 2013. And we were all chatting at that wooden table by the window.
Emily says the story all started with a phone call. She wanted to track down a filmmaker she'd read about in the newspaper, and she thought, why don't I call the reporter? Maybe he can help me get in touch.
He picked up the phone and he said, you know, hi, I'm Doug Harlow, but with his mechanical voice. And I was like, I really like this piece you wrote. Also, what's up with you? And he goes, you should do a story about me. I'm fascinating.
Now, if you keep things tuned to Maine Public, and I know you might because you're listening to this, or maybe if you're listening to NPR all day in your home city, you might recognize Emily's name and voice. That's because she hosts the NPR science podcast Shortwave. But back in 2013, when she met Doug, she was just learning how to be a reporter.
Doug changed my life. Not because of the piece. It's because I got to watch Doug do journalism. There was something about Georgia hanging out with your dad at the Skowhegan office of the Sentinel that was, it was just exciting. Like the phones were ringing, he was taking the calls, he was making the calls, he was gathering information. It was like being a detective. And because I was hanging out with him for hours on end, I got to actually shadow a journalist. And I remember at some point in the reporting saying to him, like, what is it? What's just personal question? What's it like to do journalism, and do you like it? And what I remember him saying was, I never get bored and I learn something new every day. And I was like, wow, that's a way to live.
Doug spent his life telling stories. He reported for the Morning Sentinel for 31 years.
He loved what he did. He kind of toyed around with the idea of retiring, but
he loved going into the office, loved being part of the community. Sometime around his 70th birthday, though, he started not feeling well.
He had been in and out of the doctor's office. He had been really sick. He had been losing weight. And then he was diagnosed with lung cancer. I think it was the last time I had, last time I was at the house, he got a call from Dale Lancaster, who was a deputy in Somerset County. And, you know, this always gets me because he answered the phone. It was a Friday afternoon. And Dale said, Doug, I haven't heard from you in weeks. Where have you been? And Dale didn't even know that he had cancer. My dad didn't really tell that many people. And he just said, you know, I've got lung cancer. I'm getting pretty tired. And Dale, you could just hear it in his voice. Dale was devastated. And he just said, I'm so sorry to hear that, Doug. And thank you for picking up my call today. And I'll be praying for you. And he died not long after that.
Doug passed away in 2019. He was 70 years old.
One of his last big stories was the Fighting Indians.
Doug's hometown of Skowhegan was the last school in Maine to use a Native American mascot. And throughout the town, there were really strong opinions about what to do.
You know, he called me and he was like, I really don't know. And this one kind of stumped him. He's like, I don't know the best way to approach this, because, you know, he had probably had his own opinions, which how can you not? And he said that people were being really cruel to him, especially online.
Doug seemed to have a philosophy that applied as much to himself as the work that he did.
He said, I know people just want to be heard. People just want to be heard. Yeah.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Georgia. And thank you, Doug. Up next is another very local story that really gets into what it means to belong to a place. When a no-sale order went into effect in March 2020, right at the start of the pandemic, there was this massive cruise ship named the Oceana Riviera, and it needed a place to dock. Luckily, there's a small fishing town in Maine that has the deepest natural port in the continental U.S. Seems like it could be the perfect fit, right? Well, let's listen. This is The Only Port of Call from 2020. By Mariah Dennis.
If you drive all the way to the most eastern point in America, you'll find Eastport, Maine. population 1,300. Esports a close-knit community that depends on fishing and the summer tourist season. But with the pandemic, locals were worried about the summer. But then Chris Gardner got a call. Chris is the executive director of the Eastport Port Authority. The CDC had issued a no-sail order on all U.S. cruise ships back in March because of the pandemic. Cruise ships all around the world needed a place to tie up. The Oceana Riviera is a cruise ship about the size of the Titanic, and it needed a place to dock too. Chris was ready.
If it floats, we can tie it up.
The Port Authority stood to make almost $50,000 per month if the Riviera docked in Eastport. But they needed the city council's approval first.
This was hands down the most controversial and taxing of, I think, all of the things that we have gone through as a council.
Haley Bradbury was the vice president of the Eastport City Council at the time, but she had never heard from so many people before.
I was inundated with emails, with letters, with phone calls, with people stopping me on the sidewalk and expressing vehemently how they felt about this.
When the Port Authority announced plans for the arrival of the Riviera on Facebook, locals sounded off in the comments.
I still say absolutely not.
This sounds like a great opportunity for Eastport to bring in some money during
this will help quell the misinformation rumor mill.
No, from me.
Cruise ships are the cleanest, most sterile ships.
Has anyone on the ship tested positive for COVID-19?
The Eastport City Council ordered an emergency meeting on Zoom in early May to discuss the Riviera. Usually, 20 or 30 people might show up to a city council meeting. On that night, it was closer to 100. President Rocky Archer called the meeting to order.
This meeting is for the purpose of the cruise ship. Apparently may come to Eastport. We don't know yet.
The debate boiled down to a question of safety. Eastport hadn't seen a COVID case yet. But earlier that spring, one person who'd been on the Riviera later tested positive. Locals who work in healthcare spoke up at the meeting.
My main concern is that should this ship come, there's no question that it will increase the risk to the community.
Although the Riviera didn't have any passengers, there was a skeleton crew of 138 people on board. They'd been on the ship since March. Here's the council president again.
And as far as being airborne from the ship has pretty much been in quarantine for 40-some days.
As the meeting went on, comments were blowing up the Zoom chat. Here's Chris from the Port Authority.
I know there are people out there right now that probably are burning up their keyboard trying to come at me in different ways, and that's fine.
Well, they are.
By the time the meeting ended, the council still hadn't made a decision. David Oya owns a gift shop near Eastport, and he was horrified by what he heard in the city council meetings.
I saw a lot of hate, like people was losing the kindness, and somehow I felt like, oh my God, we're losing a little bit of humanity.
Chris got a lot of calls that week.
I've been a police officer for a lot of years and a high school coach, so I'm used to being yelled at. But it was contentious. Man, there was some days I went through absolute character assassination in this island.
The port announced that the Riviera's crew wouldn't be allowed to leave the ship while it was in Eastport. And so lots of people didn't see the ship as much of a risk anymore. They saw it as an opportunity. And the next week, City Council held a second meeting to vote. The final count came in 4-1. It was settled. The Riviera was coming to Eastport. On the morning the Riviera was set to arrive, people came out to see the ship dock with their own eyes.
We clunked ourselves down here in a spot that would be perfect with our cups of coffee and our cameras. There were hundreds of people.
Here's Chris.
My Lord. I just got blown away by the sheer size of it. You know, it looked just like a boat until it started getting closer and growing and growing and growing. And then when it was here, that's when it hit me in the sense that, wow. We've never seen anything like this in Eastport, Maine.
When Tania Pena first heard the Riviera would be headed to Eastport, she had to Google where Eastport was. Tania works on the Riviera in the housekeeping department. And the first thing she heard was that Eastport was worried the ship would bring in COVID.
Because, you know, in the beginning, we heard like some rumors, you know, like the people were afraid about us to bring coronavirus in Eastport.
But Tania had been isolated on the ship for weeks. She knew that the ship just needed a place to tie up.
And I was like, no, we don't have coronavirus on board. We just want to stay there.
She began looking for more information on Eastport and found a Facebook page called Eastport Maine Information and News. As the Riviera approached town, she sent a message.
Hi, I am crew members from Riviera. We are happy to be here.
Don Dunbar is a local photographer and one of the admins of the Facebook page. He was taking photos of the Riviera as it came in, and then his phone started buzzing.
They started reaching out, asking questions about Eastport.
Tania and Don started messaging back and forth.
And he started to ask me, how are you? How is everything on board? Are you okay?
Businesses saw the impact of the Riviera almost immediately.
People were coming from Calais. They were coming from Baileyville, from Machias. They were doing a day trip from Bangor. People came to see the cruise ship. So they wandered through town. They shopped in Ray's Mustard. They came.
On the first day the Riviera was in town, the hot dog stand sold out of hot dogs, and the diner sold out of seafood.
It was amazing.
It was a tourist attraction. Let's go down and see the big ship.
As the weeks went on, Tania and other members of the crew kept reaching out to locals on Facebook. And many people in town started to feel bad for them.
Yes, it was great for the port to make money. They well needed, but they were people on that ship, you know, that are hungry for information or any outside contact. And
I think it took about 2 weeks of people saying that there's no COVID on this ship, but then people started saying, well, geez, poor bastards are stuck on that ship.
Yeah.
Literally, that's the word, the poor bastards, you know.
People who were against the ship in the beginning, when they started thinking about it from the point of view of there's actually human beings on the ship, and we started looking at it that way, a lot of them softened their opinions.
And locals and crew started to become friends.
They would send pictures of the town from up there, and we'd send pictures from what they looked like here, and it's just a daily conversation.
The breakwater was closed off to residents while the Riviera was docked. But people walked up to the barricade and waved to the crew. The Riviera had to leave port every once in a while to desalinate water that the crew could use on board. And so one day, as the Riviera headed out, Don had an idea.
I made up 2 cardboard hands, red ones, with yellow happy faces on them. And I called them happy hands. So when they pulled back in the next day to port, we had also put it on Facebook to come out and welcome the ship back.
There were people all along the waterfront waiting for the ship. And when it returned, the crew was shocked.
And when we returned, it was such a big surprise. And we were like, uh-oh, they are really waiting for us.
They made a big banner that said thank you with a heart and unfurled it over the balcony of the ship. In the end of July, the town got word that Europe was starting to open up. And so the Riviera would be headed to Italy. On one of its last days in port, Don organized a small concert for the crew. 2 musicians set up on the fish pier, which stuck out right near the stern of the Riviera. The crew came out to the back deck and danced to the music. Locals came out to watch the concert from a distance. And when the Riviera pushed off, the town said goodbye from the gangplank.
I was happy for the crew. I was just selfishly kind of bummed, like, oh, this is like the highlight of the summer and now they're leaving. So it just seemed really empty after they left. Like, I almost cried when they were falling away.
It was a lot of people crying and they were crying. And it, to me, that was a moment that I would never forget.
And after months on board the ship, Tania and the crew of the Riviera finally disembarked in Italy. But they'll never forget the welcome Eastport gave them.
Even in this difficult time, you make us feel like at home. Even we were so far from our family. And for me, I always will say that Eastport, you can find a family there.
In the early days of the pandemic, it was hard to imagine what the summer would look like. But the arrival of the Riviera gave Eastport hope.
Looking out the window of my office, I mean, it certainly changed the view, which was probably the most visually spectacular, but what has to be really noted was the fact that it just changed the way the town felt. Too often, we spend so much time worrying about the things that we don't have that we look right over the top of all the things that we do have. It's in times like that where you really got to take a step back, take a big breath, and realize, you know what? We're pretty damn lucky.
That was The Only Port of Call from Mariah Dennis. You know, when I drive into Portland's Old Port in the summer, I know the massive cruise ships mean different things to different people. Some see the water slides and the city skyline and the tour buses leaving the dock as a welcome sign of the season. But other people see, you know, congestion, smoke, people billowing to shore for a few hours and then clearing back out. That's part of what I find so fascinating about the ship in Mariah's story. We get to know it and spend some more time with it. The Oceana Riviera made a lasting impact, creating a permanent bond between the crew and the locals who learned to love the ship. And this story lets all of us listeners in on that shared time and place in Eastport. Thank you for listening. There are 6 episodes in this season of Essential Salt. We obviously hope you listen to all of them, but if you need a laugh, and I know you might, then the next episode in the series is the one you gotta hear.
Oh my God, this is so good. Get this one and I'll tell you what it means.
Oh yeah.
Join us for a wild ride, hunting for the best vanity license plates in Maine. It's so good. We're really excited to bring you these in-depth, beautifully crafted stories about Maine that really get Maine. Local storytelling is powerful, and we believe it helps us be better neighbors and maybe even better versions of ourselves. Support this kind of storytelling here in Maine. Head to mainepublic.org/storytelling to contribute now. Thank you. We'll see you next time. I'm Jess Miller. Essential Salt is produced by Brenna Farrell, with help from Lucy Santerre. Thanks to Isaac Kestenbaum at Salt. Thanks also to Theo Balcom. Our executive producer is Susan Tran. Audio mixing by Steven Jackson. Essential Salt features original music composed by Q-Shop. You can find more music for storytelling at cue-shop.co. Support for Essential Salt comes from St. Mary's Health System in Lewiston, growing and evolving to best serve the needs of the community since 1888. Learn more at stmarysmaine.com.